are listening to Right On Radio. I'm Eric Zimmerman. On tonight's program, Josh will be talking with Augustina Paglayan about her new book, Raised to Obey, The Rise and Spread of Mass Education. Paglayan's work examines how the expansion of primary education in the West emerged not from democratic ideals, but from the state's desire to control its citizens. All of this and more, so stay tuned to Right On Radio.
This evening, I'm talking with Augustina Paglayan about her new work, Raised to Obey, The Rise and Spread of Mass Education, drawing on unparalleled evidence from two centuries of education provision in Europe and the Americas, and deploying rich data that captures the expansion of primary education and its characteristics. Raised to Obey offers a political history of primary schools that is both broad and deep. Augustina is a political science and public policy professor at the University of California, San Diego, and a non-resident fellow at the Center for Global Development. She is internationally renowned for her expertise in how politics shapes and is shaped by education systems. Augustina, welcome to Right On Radio.
Thank you, Josh. I'm thrilled to be here.
Your book argues that education systems historically aim at social control rather than reducing inequality. Could you elaborate on how this goal shaped early educational policies in Western societies?
Sure. Let me begin by clarifying a little bit what I mean by social control. So the primary goal of mass education when it emerged in the West was to teach children to respect the state and its laws and essentially to form obedient citizens. And so when you think of how education systems were designed to accomplish, all kinds of policies were used. So the curriculum, for example, focused primarily on teaching a specific set of moral principles that particularly highlighted the importance of being obedient and respecting rules. The training of teachers and the certification of teachers also focused on instilling in teachers the moral values that they were supposed to then transmit to children, and also screening teachers based on whether they had the right moral character to be the agents of the state in teaching obedience. Inspection policies were also adopted to have ICE in classrooms to deploy inspectors who were checking whether schools were actually doing an effective job of instilling discipline, instilling obedience. And finally, there were also compulsory schooling laws that were passed because governments were concerned that if education focused on social control purposes, parents were not going to want to send their children to school. And so they instituted compulsory schooling as a means to force parents to send their kids to school.
In your research, what evidence did you find most compelling in linking state-regulated education to efforts that maintain social order?
You know, social control theories of mass education have been around for quite a while, and they were dismissed several decades ago as being cynical interpretations of history or lacking in evidence. So I'm glad you're asking this question, because I also used to think of these theories as sort of conspiracy theories. There are many different pieces of evidence that changed my mind, but I will say that the most compelling is simply looking at what politicians said when they debated the design and the idea of creating a mass education system. They did not hide in any way that the goal of these systems was to convert unruly children into obedient citizens who had unquestioned respect for the state and its laws. So I think that that's, their book has, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of statistical evidence, also all kinds of quantitative evidence. But I personally find that the most compelling is just hearing politicians in their own words say what was the reason why they developed these systems.
I was debating if I should bring this up or not, but I mean, what are your, I think with some of Trump's rhetoric, I know he has also talked about defunding the Department of Education in the United States due to concerns of federal overreach, I think, the classroom. I think, what was your response to that? Do you see that as an example of social control in the classroom?
So let me first clarify that while Trump has said that he wants to dismantle the Department of Education, he has also made it extremely clear that he plans to use the power of the federal government to shape the curriculum across the country. And what he has also made clear is that the goal of his efforts to shape the curriculum are to promote patriotic education, to instill a love for the United States, to instill respect and admiration toward existing political institutions. And so in this respect, everything that Trump has announced is no anomaly. It just fits this cross-national pattern and a centuries-old playbook of using education for social control purposes.
So I'm going to jump forward here, I guess, another question I had here. Your work suggests that fear of internal threats plays a critical role in educational expansion. Could you discuss specific historical examples where this fear directly influenced policy decisions?
Yes, and again, let me say something first about this point, which is that when you have internal threats against the status quo, that's what the book shows are the instances when governments become particularly fearful of the masses, of their moral values, and therefore become more interested in putting children in schools to teach them that the status quo is actually okay. Examples of this abound, and the book is full of them. But for example, the first law requiring primary schooling in the world was in Prussia in 1763, and that was a law that was instituted in response to a series of peasant revolts that led the king at the time to conclude that the current policies that were in place to try to forge social order were insufficient, and that what needed to happen was also to educate children to respect the king and his authority. In the United States, in Massachusetts, Shays Rebellion in the 1780s also played a key role in triggering the first Massachusetts education law, because that rebellion created anxiety among political elites about the unruly and immoral character of the masses, and led them to come to an agreement that education, mass education, was really important for converting this undisciplined lower classes into obedient citizens and submissive also. These are, again, the words that they used. That's why it's so compelling. It's just to read it in the words. Then throughout Latin America, in Argentina, in Chile, in Colombia, there are numerous examples where civil wars in which the masses participated in violence against the state, those civil wars were key triggers of the creation of primary education systems and the expansion of primary education. So there's many different examples, but the common thread is that internal threats against the state's authority heighten elites' fear of the masses and then lead them to focus on education as a means of preventing dissent.
Let's talk a little further about this. What are some key milestones in the evolution of global primary education enrollment, do you think?
There's a lot of different things that one could look at here in response to this question. I'd say, just to give people a big picture, the two main things that states did to create mass education were first to pass a lot of education laws that regulated the curriculum, regulated who could become a teacher. And then the other thing that they also did was to construct schools, to hire the teachers, and essentially to expand primary education. If you look at this history of the creation and expansion of primary education systems, Prussia led the way under an absolutist regime. Then the US followed, and Canada as well, and continental Europe also followed. And then Latin America came after that. And finally, much later, you had Asia and Africa. So the West was the part of the world that paradoxically led the development of state-regulated mass education for social control purposes, even though today we associate it with maybe the autocracies in Asia and think of China as doing a lot of indoctrination. The idea of using education to indoctrinate came from the West, or was at first implemented most forcefully in the West.
What role did elites play in championing or opposing mass education? How did their motivations shift over time? Because I think that when I first think about initially with recognition or sponsoring of primary education, I mean, like for the turn of the 19th century, I could see like big tycoons and building public institutions or libraries, but I think that attitude has changed over time.
Yes, there has been some change. So at first, it was really elites that were championing mass education because they had a conception of what mass education was that was completely different from our conception of mass education today. They thought mass education is equivalent to indoctrinating people for obedience. And so they were the ones that pushed forward. And precisely because of how they thought of mass education, you didn't really have many elites opposing it. They didn't think of mass education as something that could empower the masses. But over time, you did start seeing changes, particularly around World War II. New theories emerged that linked education with economic development, with reductions in income inequality. And so at that point, you start seeing changes in the kinds of arguments that elites are making, and you start seeing some elites actually say that they're going to expand education for promoting economic development or reducing poverty and inequality. Now, what they say in this post-war period isn't necessarily what they think, because there's also really interesting and, in my view, compelling evidence that others have done that shows that even today, when you ask education policymakers what are the main goals of education, they think that docile citizens is a much more important goal than eradicating illiteracy, for example. So there has been some addition of new goals, but I think that the goals and the goal of indoctrination has changed much less than we might think.
Could you explain the variations in educational reforms following key conflicts, like such as France's civil unrest in the 19th century or Chile's internal struggles?
Yes, and these were, as you point out, very different types of internal conflicts. In the case of France, it was rural riots, people who were hungry, who were blaming the government for their hunger. And so they were destroying tax collection agencies, destroying granaries. In the case of Chile, it was a civil war in which people were upset about the level of central government intromission in provincial affairs. There was also anger at the intervention of the church in state matters. So the causes of these conflicts, the scope, there were a lot of different things that varied between France and Chile and other examples that I talk about in the book. But what you actually see is a common response, which is that central governments then respond to these protests by creating and expanding mass education systems with the goal of instilling in children the idea that respecting authority, respecting rules, and ultimately respecting the state is the most important thing that they need to learn. It varies. There are variations. So there are some countries, for example, where the moral education that the state is imparting is religious. There's a very high component of religious doctrine in the teaching of moral principles like you shouldn't steal, you shouldn't lie, you shouldn't cheat, you shouldn't kill. And in other countries, they have a moral education that is secular. It's not based on religious principles. But you do see consistently after these internal conflicts an emphasis on moral education.
What role did political instability and elite anxiety concerning social order play into driving rural versus urban education efforts?
So a lot of the internal conflicts and threats to the authority of the state that occurred often came from the rural areas, the ones that were farthest away from the capital. And what happened then was that the states then responded by primarily expanding primary education in those rural areas, not in the urban areas. And one of the things that they also thought very carefully is like, well, the goal of this expansion of rural education is not to equip people with skills for industrialization. We're not trying to develop these backward areas economically. The goal, again, here is to convert these rural masses into obedient, civilized citizens. And so one of the things that states often did was to have different curricula for rural areas versus urban areas, precisely so that the children in rural areas weren't learning skills that could then be used for getting a job in the city. They didn't want them to move to work in a factory. They wanted to stay in the rural areas, to stay there contentedly, and to respect the state's authority.
How do national curriculums reflect the priorities of social control rather than skill development or critical thinking. And I was wondering if you could also talk about how democracies try to reconcile the tension between promoting critical thinking and maintaining social control through education.
So let me start with the first one of how national curriculums even today reflect social control priorities more so than skill development or critical thinking. So you can see, for example, all of the emphasis that schools often place on rote learning and memorization. You can also see how there are all kinds of rules in school that kids have to comply with, even if a lot of those rules are arbitrary and completely questionable. But the point is for kids to learn that rules are there, that they are imposed by others, and that they need to respect them. There's also all kinds of punishments and rewards for complying with rules that are there to induce kids to learn to comply. And punishment doesn't have to be physical abuse or hitting a kid. It can be simply humiliating a kid, making them feel bad in front of their peers and classmates for having talked without raising their hand, or other forms of rule violation. There's also a lot of emphasis, and this comes from some evidence that I gathered with a group of social scientists looking cross-nationally at 160 countries. Most countries around the world, when they teach history, they focus on teaching a particular interpretation of historical events instead of exposing children to diverse viewpoints and diverse interpretations and letting them make up their own minds based on the evidence that they are provided with about which interpretation they find more compelling. So that's, again, an example of social control as opposed to encouraging critical thinking. Even the classroom setup, right, is designed for highlighting the authority of the teacher, with the teacher standing in front, the kids sitting in desks. So there's all kinds of things. But to your question also about how do democracies reconcile promoting critical thinking and maintaining social control? What democracies have done is to allow critical thinking when they teach certain subjects like science. If you're learning photosynthesis, kids can ask, well, but why does it work that way? And why does it work that way? So if you're learning science or you're learning geography or some subjects, there's democracies allow more critical thinking in those subjects. But what they don't typically allow is for kids to question the moral and political values that justify the existence of democracy. So you are taught that voting is the most legitimate way to express your discontent and that violence is always wrong. And that's an example of indoctrination, because it's an example where, as the word indoctrination indicates, according to the dictionary, kids are being taught to accept a set of beliefs uncritically. That's the definition of indoctrination in the dictionary. If you do not allow kids to question, but why is democracy the best? Why are elections the best way for choosing leaders? And why is violence always wrong? That's not allowing that critical thinking to happen in the classroom is a form of social control.
So you discuss indoctrination as a primary motive for state-regulated education. How has this motive changed with economic or military motivations in different periods?
So again, back to the post-war period. In the post-war, with the context of the Cold War, you start seeing a lot of concerns about economic competitiveness and being able to claim that you are the economic superpower and the military superpower. And so in that context, you start seeing, for example, the U.S. moving away from its focus on patriotism and social control, and suddenly noticing that the Soviet Union isn't just indoctrinating students, that they're also putting a lot of emphasis on teaching everyone strong scientific and technical skills. And so that changes a little bit the conversation among education policymakers in the U.S., where they start talking about how, well, they need to catch up. They don't want to fall behind.
According to your findings, how does indoctrination in democratic and authoritarian systems operate comparatively? How are they similar and different?
So they are similar. This is incredibly interesting. Again, back to this data that we gathered from 160 countries. If you ask education experts, to what extent does the history curriculum focus on teaching a specific set of moral and political values that substantiate or justify a particular social and political order, you're going to see that their responses in autocracies and democracies are extremely similar, and across regimes, there's a very heavy emphasis on doing this. What differs very much between autocracies and democracies is which are the specific moral and political values that are being taught. So in the case of democracies, you can probably guess that the democracies, their education systems are teaching kids that democracy is the best system in the world, whereas in autocracies, that's not what they teach primarily in history lessons or in other classes. And then the other big difference is not only in the content of the indoctrination, but also, as I said earlier, about the room for critical thinking, that there's a little bit more room for kids questioning the things that they are taught, not so much when they're learning about politics and the existing political institutions, but more generally. But even so, the other really interesting thing is that even if democracies allow more critical thinking than autocracies, when you look at how much room for critical thinking is there versus how much emphasis is there on teaching a particular set of moral and political values, well, the latter is actually more prevalent than the encouragement of critical thinking.
What do you tell critics who argue that emphasizing indoctrination overlooks education's emancipatory potential, or the historical evidence suggesting education has fostered social mobility and democratization in some context?
So first, let me say, for me, that's not a criticism at all, because one of the things that the book shows is that some of the moral education curricula that were put in place for social control purposes actually contained some elements that you could imagine they inadvertently led to social mobility. The other thing I'll also say is I'm living proof of the fact that education can empower people to live a meaningful, autonomous life. So I sympathize with that claim. But as a social scientist, my goal is to try to detect general patterns and to try to detect whether my experience with education as an empowering experience, whether that's the most common experience or whether that's more an anomaly than the norm. And that's where I think the evidence becomes clear, that if you look around the world, one third of kids who have 4 years of schooling cannot read a simple sentence. So that tells me that there is a massive failure on the part of education systems to do something extremely basic. Likewise, in the United States, kids come into kindergarten with, among high-income kids, much higher literacy skills than low-income kids, and schools fail to close those achievement gaps. So there are a lot of social scientific pieces of evidence that suggest that for most people, and particularly for low-income people, schools are not delivering on their promise.
How do you
if they have for me, right?
How do you see the relationship between education, inequality, and stability evolving, considering your research?
That's an interesting question. Let me think a little bit more about that. So I think one possibility is for people to worry that if you don't use education for social control, that that's going to lead to more political instability, that in some ways you need to compromise to do less effort to empower people and to promote social mobility for the sake of social cohesion, for the sake of social order. And I think the jury on that is actually still out. So I can imagine, based on personal experience also, how someone with very strong critical thinking skills might, based on their own reasoning capabilities, decide that they don't want to rebel against the state. So I think we often tend to assume that critical thinking is destabilizing when we don't actually have evidence that it is. It is a very common assumption, but we don't really know. And if you go back to the attack on the Capitol on January 6th, I would hypothesize again, this is for others to study, but I would hypothesize that the level of critical thinking skills among those who participated in the Capitol wasn't among the highest across the United States. So there's a question there, I think, for future people to study. Is it actually the case that critical thinking is destabilizing, as most people fear?
Ooh, okay, we got, I think, enough time for one more question. I really want to ask you this. What lessons can policymakers today draw from the historical roots, and I guess examples like the raid on the Capitol in January 2021 to address current challenges like inequality and the learning crisis and lacking critical thinking skills?
So one of the key lessons is that education systems in democracies today, including in the United States, were either inherited or copied from absolutist education systems, starting with the Prussian example. These systems were not conceived for the sake of making people develop or helping people develop the critical thinking skills that make democracy resilient. And so I think one of the key implications of the book is that both for the sake of democracy and for the sake of the economy, we need to completely rethink education systems. And this isn't about adding a subject or tweaking the way we teach civics education. This is about transforming education systems so as to emphasize critical thinking skills a lot more than we do today, and of course, basic skills that support social mobility as well. And the challenge that I think the book also identifies is that the challenge in order to transform this is not a policy challenge. It's not a technical challenge of how do we actually promote critical thinking. The challenge is much more political. How do you get governments who fear people who might have strong critical thinking skills, how do you get governments to actually adopt the policies that would lead to a transformation of education for the sake of promoting critical thinking? That's all I have to say on that.
I think it's a great place to leave off on that. This has been my time talking to Agustina Pagliarin, the author of Raise to Obey, The Rise and Spread of Mass Education, available now from Princeton University Press. Agustina, thanks for being with us on the program.
Thank you, Josh. I really enjoyed this.
And now this.
You have been listening to Right On Radio. I'm Eric, and we would like to thank Agustina Pagliarin and all of our listeners. Without your support, KFAI would not be possible.